Our second plenary session will be delivered by Dr. Larry Kreitzer. Dr. Kreitzer began his academic career as a New Testament scholar, and in fact received his doctorate in New Testament from this seminary. He still lectures, I'm assuming, in New Testament, both at Regent's Park College in Oxford, as well as Oriel College since 1990. In Oxford. But in recent years, he has become involved in fairly extensive research and publication in the whole area of 17th century Baptist life, and particularly focusing on William Kiffin, although he has brought out a fabulous two-volume work on Oxford Baptists and the origins of the Baptist work in Oxford in the 17th century. Last year you were here, or was it 2 years ago? 2 years ago, when we did 17th Century Baptist Life, he treated us to a fabulous presentation on certain aspects of the life of William Kiffin. Pretty well anybody who's done work in English Baptist history knows about Kiffin. The truth of the matter is we really don't know Kiffin. There is so much of his life that has been kind of hidden in many respects, in archives, and Larry is in the process, Dr. Kreitzer is in the process of uncovering that. He has one volume of work that has already been published, William Kiffin and His World. A second volume is about to be published, and Steve will actually pass out the sheets that relate to this. And I understand that there are, is it six more after this? William Kiffin is a very important figure, but it's absolutely amazing how much material there is there that really has never really seen the light of day, and will transform, I hope, our way of thinking about early Baptists in the 17th century. Larry is going to come and speak to us this morning on the topic of the Valiant Old Lady, the story of the Eighth Whelp, and her Baptist chaplain, John Pendarvis.
Thank you very much, Michael. There is a handout. I hope everybody has a copy of a handout which contains the text of four different documents that I'll be looking at. The paper that I'm about to give you concerns 10 different documents, but I've given you the text of four of those 10. So we'll refer to them as we go along. If you want to have the other six, then you can maybe email me and I can send you the other ones that form the substance of this particular paper. The Valiant Old Lady, by the way, is the name that was given to the ship, the Eighth Whelp, in case you're curious. In the standard book on English Navy in the Civil War period, meaning the English Civil War. Now, there's always been something of a mystery about parts of the life of John Pendarves, the controversial Baptist leader and fifth monarchist. Pendarves served as the pastor of the Baptist Church in Abingdon, near Oxford, from about 1650 until his early death at the age of 34 in September of 1656. And he's probably best known because his funeral on the 2nd of October, 1656, became a flashpoint between the Baptist mourners and government soldiers who feared a nationalist uprising of fifth monarchists. Documents from the 1640s leave us a thin paper trail of Pendarves' life within the area at the time. That Pendarves was a student at Exeter College in Oxford from 1638 to 1642 can be confirmed by college records, as can his taking a Bachelor of Arts degree within the University of Oxford on the 3rd of March, 1642. In addition, there is an intriguing note within the accounts of Abingdon City Council for the year 1644 to 1645, recording that Pendarves was paid £5, quote, for his pains, end quote, as a minister in the city. Yet it's somewhat odd that we have no information about Pendarves' activities in the Oxfordshire, Berkshire area in the period between these two phases of his life. So what became of John Pendarves between the time that he graduated from university in the spring of 1642 and the time that he began to serve as a parish minister in St. Helen's Church in Abingdon in about 1645? Generally, it's assumed that he stayed within the Oxford-Abingdon area, establishing himself as a minister of the gospel. However, attention needs to be given to a passing comment made by Bernard Capp in his excellent study, Cromwell's Navy. Capp makes the following comment, and it's just a footnote. Pendarves had been a Navy chaplain on the 8th Whelp in 1644. That's it. That's the only thing he says. Unfortunately, the evidence from naval records such as this has never been fully explored for what it might tell us about Pendarves' early life. Indeed, Capp's note identifies only one small piece of a very large puzzle, and there are many other sources which he does not cite, both within Admiralty records and in related printed documents, which need to be brought to the discussion. So within this study, I propose to attempt to address this matter. I'll argue that for a short period of his life, John Pendarves served as a Navy chaplain aboard the 8th Whelp, a ship on the side of Parliament in the Civil War. A careful study of available Navy records dealing with this ship will provide a context for assessing Pendarves' life in chaplaincy service aboard her. This will also help us to understand better why in 1653, Pendarves was one of the Baptist and Independent ministers to whom John Carew and the commissioners of the Admiralty, in this letter that's on the screen, turned in support to these Baptist and Independent ministers, asking them to provide better religious provision for seamen serving in the Parliamentary Army and in the Parliamentary Navy. Pendarves was naturally sympathetic. He himself had served aboard a Navy ship, so he knew what it was like and what it entailed. Now, it's not very often that you get an insight of detail about what was involved with somebody serving aboard a ship. And I hope to lift the lid off of that and make this study from the bottom up, as it were. The story of John Pendarves' life as a chaplain aboard the Parliamentary warship 8th Whelp has to be read out of a handful of Navy documents, many of them coming from those who either sailed in or alongside her. The most important of these are court depositions made before the High Court of Admiralty in London, although there are three other supplementary documents which also have a significant contribution to make. The bulk of the study then will be given over to providing a discussion of nine key Admiralty documents, most written between January and June of 1644. Two of these are court depositions made by John Pendarves himself. Four are depositions made by other naval officers and seamen who had contact with the 8th Whelp during the period that Pendarves was aboard her. The final three Navy documents are associated with a ship called the Sarah, which was captured by the 8th Whelp in January of 1644. Most significantly, one of these final three documents was actually written by John Pendarves himself, providing us with a rare example of his handwriting and his signature. The tenth document, the final one that we'll mention, is a tangential document, but a very interesting one, which gives an informer's report about John Pendarves' role as a fifth monarchist arms trader or arms dealer. Now, inevitably, documents of this type will not answer all of the questions that we would like to raise. That's just the nature of the evidence that we have to deal with. But through these nine Navy documents, we can gain some insight into what life was like aboard a ship during the Civil War, where she sailed, what she did, what the concerns and preoccupations were for the 8th Whelp's captain and crew, what motivated and inspired them to pursue a life of danger on the sea, and danger it was. Together, the six depositions offer us a glimpse in what life was like aboard this eighth whelp, and allow us to enter, however imperfectly and momentarily, into the world of John Pendarves. It's important to note that the handwriting of the depositions is extremely difficult to read. You'll see that when we come to look at a couple of pictures of it. And the documents are filled with nautical expressions, technical terms, and abbreviations. I knew more about the Navy now than I ever thought I would, just from trying to deal with these documents. Nevertheless, the advantages of wrestling with documents like these are, even though they're written in a devilish hand at times, is just a minor inconvenience. The benefits far outweigh the disadvantages. So we'll go in three headings, really. First, the two depositions that John Pendarves wrote himself before the High Court of the Admiralty. We'll have a look at those. Then secondly, a brief history of the ship that he's on. And thirdly, the time that he is aboard the Eighth Whelp under the captain whose name was William Thomas. So first, let's look at John Pendarves' depositions before the High Court of the Admiralty. And within the National Archives at Kew in London, there is a mammoth volume of 798 foliated pages. It's so big and heavy you can hardly pick it up. It's entitled High Court of the Admiralty Depositions and Proceedings, 1644-1645. And it contains sworn depositions taken down as evidence before the Navy courts, generally as part of an ongoing investigation or evidence-seeking activity into naval matters, mostly dealing with the capture of enemy vessels, which is generally called the taking of a prize, the taking of prizes. That's how they entitle that. These investigations commonly involved a person being questioned by a panel of Navy officers who comprised the prize court of the Admiralty, and generally depositions were made in response to formal charges or questions known as interrogatories. These related to the activities of a particular ship at a particular time, and statements given in such proceedings were then written down by court clerks and signed by the person offering the evidence. It's quite a formal procedure, but that's how they did it. This official record of the Navy Court is the starting point for our study, for it contains two sworn statements made by John Pendarves. This is the first of those two, a signed deposition concerning the Eighth Whelp's role in the capture of a ship called the Dove, and it is dated 17 May 1644. The second statement given by Pendarves before the Admiralty Court was 10 days later, on the 27th of May, 1644, and it relates what he has to say about the Eighth Whelp's participation in the capture of a ship called the Sarah. Now, the two statements are all the more interesting for the personal details that Pendarves offers about himself, and you have the two statements that he gives as documents 1 and 2 on your handout. Pendarves tells us his age. He's 24 or 25 or thereabouts. His place of birth he gives as Crowan in Cornwall, and you get a hint of where Cornwall is in England, and the arrow shows you where Crowan is, and a declaration of his qualifications and educational level. He gives his qualifications as a Bachelor of Arts, meaning he's graduated from one of the two universities in England, Oxford or Cambridge. He's from Oxford, of course. He also describes his position on board the ship. He's a minister of the Eighth Whelp. The two statements are also interesting because they are actually signed by Pendarves, again giving us one of those rare examples of his signature. I think there are only three documents in total that bear Pendarves' signature. One is in Washington, D.C. in the Folger Library, and one in the National Archives in London. These two depositions by Pendarves offer intriguing, if altogether too brief, insights into his life aboard the Eighth Whelp. But what else do we know about that ship, her history, and her activities in the service of Parliament? A brief exploration of this will help us appreciate more fully Pendarves' time as chaplain aboard that ship. The Aethelwulf was part of a series of 10 ships altogether. They were designated the Lion's Whelps, and they were numbered. The Lion's first whelp, the Lion's second whelp, the Lion's third whelp, and so on. They were built originally in the late 1620s at the order of Charles I. They originally were built to deal with the Dunkirk pirates, who played havoc with English ships operating in the English Channel during the Anglo-French War of 1627-1628. They were all paid for by the friend and confidant of Charles I, the Duke of Buckingham, Sir George Villiers. And the total cost of construction of these 10 little ships ran to approximately £7,000. That's a huge amount of money in those days. Their construction was supervised by Captain John Pennington, who later became the Admiral of the Fleet, and Captain Phineas Pett. Both these men were appointed by Villiers in 1628. And the actual construction of the 10 whelps was contracted out to 9 different shipwrights, and they were paid at a rate of £3.05 per ton. However, whatever the ship weighed determined how much money the shipbuilders got for it. And the 8th and 9th whelps together were built in accordance with these contractual arrangements by a man named John Graves in the Limestone Docks in London. Now, they were square-rigged ships with 3 masts, and they were all under 200 tons in burden. Each ship had 14 guns mounted on a single deck, 7 cannons on each side, although some of the cannons were stored in the hold during normal service. They built the ships in such a way that if they loaded all the cannons on it, it was too heavy to float. So they had to store them until they may have needed them. There was an excess of heavy cannon for the size of the decks. Now, each whelp was manned by about 60 sailors. And the 10 whelps were also equipped with a series of 3-man oars, which were called sweeps, which could be used for locomotion when there was insufficient wind for the sails. And the 60-man crew had an officer staff, if you want to think of it that way, a captain, a first mate, a purser, a chaplain, of about 5 or 6. So 5 or 6 officers to serve this 60-man crew. Now, as it turns out, the 10 whelps were not destined to be the most durable of ships. For one thing, they were rather hastily built and were constructed with inferior timber, which helps account for the fact that only 1 of the 10 survived into the Commonwealth period. That was the 10th whelp. Several other whelps met with disaster within a decade of their first having set out to sea. The 6th whelp was lost in a sea storm in 1628 as it returned from the disastrous attempt by the Duke of Buckingham to lift the siege at La Rochelle in France. The 7th whelp was accidentally blown up on the 23rd of September 1630 when a seaman carried a naked candle into the powder magazine. They were fighting a Dutch at the time, and I don't know, nobody knows why this happened. Of course, the whole crew was killed. And the 4th whelp sank without loss of life on the 4th of August, 1636, after striking a rock in St. Austin's Bay in Jersey. But in contrast, the 8th whelp survived these initial catastrophes to see service in both Charles I's Navy from 1633 to 1641, as well as in the Parliamentary Navy during the Civil War from 1642 to 1645. And we have records of at least 9 different men serving as captains aboard the 8th whelp during her 18 years of naval service. That's all the time that the ship survived. And this is a list of the captains and the dates of their service as best I can reconstruct it. Now, the 8th whelp was part of Sir Algernon Percy's fleet of 1640, and it had Anthony Woolward as her captain. And the ship entered service on the side of Parliament during the Civil War, probably late in 1642. It was one of Charles I's idiotic moves in the early days of the Civil War not to secure the Navy on his side He should have done that. It may have guaranteed his victory, but he didn't. Additional documents provide us with details on some of the crew of the Eighth Whelp, as well as some of the specific responsibilities and engagements she had in service of Parliament. For example, we know that William Thomas served as her captain from the spring of 1643 to the spring of 1644, and that John Curse was her captain from 1644 until 1645. And it's a little difficult to determine precisely what part the Eighth Whelp played in any given season of activity in the fleet. It's hard to trace movements of all of the ships, although we do know that in April of 1644, the Eighth Whelp sailed up the Thames into the port of London, and that on the 21st of April, 1644, the Earl of Warwick wrote to the Navy Commissioners in London requesting that the ship be speedily made ready to return to sea, since the Dutch threatened to put many affronts on the summer. A quick transition, a quick refitting was made, and the Eighth Whelp was soon back in service. We also know that on the 1st of June, 1644, Captain Curse, he was the last captain in that list we've just seen, Captain Curse took the Eighth Whelp with a load of gold to Scotland to help pay for the maintenance of the English army there. Curse, as it turned out, was to be her last captain, and it was on his recommendation to the Navy Commissioners in July of 1645 that the Eighth Whelp was deemed unseaworthy and retired from active service. But it really is with the eighth captain, the penultimate captain of the ship, that we're most concerned. That's Captain William Thomas, because he was a very able and talented commander who was in charge of the ship during the time that Pindarve served as a chaplain aboard her. So let's turn a look at what we know about Captain William Thomas. It's not known precisely when he became captain of the Whelp, although it was probably sometime in the spring of 1643. Here you can see he's listed as a captain of the Eighth Whelp in the published list of ships for the Earl of Warwick's summer guard. They had a summer guard and a winter guard, two seasons of activity where the fleet would sail mostly in the English Channel. And the first record we have of William Thomas commanding the Eighth Whelp in the service of Parliament also dates to April of 1643, when the ship was used to transport deported Capuchin monks from the English shores. This was in fulfillment of an order issued by Parliament on the 12th of September, 1642, which expelled all Capuchins from England, clearly part of the anti-clerical reaction to what was perceived to be a Catholic threat. The Capuchins were removed from their chapel in Somerset House, and this document describes that Somerset House was then, quote, cleansed from all Romish rubbish and superstitious trumpery. A great bonfire was made to burn all their books, images, and Babylonish trinkets. So a little hostility there, no doubt. On the 10th of May, 1643, Captain Thomas took his ship, and along with a Captain Dansk, who was sailing the Charity, escorted these vessels carrying Capuchin monks to France, delivering their cargo to the French port of Morlaix on the 3rd of June. The next day, the 4th of June, Captain Thomas was to command his crew in what was perhaps the most famous engagement that the Eighth Whelp ever had. While anchored at the Isle of Bass, he learned that three Royalist vessels that were part of Charles I's remnant navy, were lying nearby off the coast of Brest. The major one of them was a ship called the Mayflower, headed by Captain Paul Hill. And Paul Hill had been conducting a very successful raiding operation in the area, preying on English merchant ships. So Captain Thomas cleverly disguised his eighth whelp as a merchant ship. He took the sails down, repainted them, and covered up all of his cannons, made it look as if he was a merchant ship, and lured Paul Hill and the Mayflower into a trap. He engaged the Mayflower at close range, and after a fierce gun battle, in which Thomas discharged 120 cannon shots into the Mayflower within an hour and a half, forced her surrender. The ship was taken by Thomas to Stokes Bay outside Portsmouth, where her crew were questioned and imprisoned. An inventory was made of the ordnance and furnishings. So the capture of the Mayflower was heralded as a great victory in the Civil War, and the reputation of Captain Thomas and the Eighth Whelp was enhanced considerably. This is a pamphlet that was published just after that battle took place. It comes out the next week, proclaiming all the great news from the sea, good news from the sea. Under Captain Thomas, the Eighth Whelp also served as part of the Earl of Warwick's fleet, which assisted in attempting to relieve the siege of Exeter in July of 1643. Now, the most important evidence we have for the activities of the Eighth Whelp in 1643-44 comes from the testimony of Captain Thomas himself. And this is a copy of the four or five pages of it. This is his sworn statement given on the 6th of June, 1644, to the High Court of the Admiralty. And from Thomas's statement, we can see that he was involved in the taking of about a dozen different ships while commanding the Eighth Whelp. In other words, the Eighth Whelp, under his command, captured at least 12 other ships, or participated in the capture of at least 12 other ships. And you can supplement Captain Thomas's statement by statements made by the other captains. And you can reconstruct a pretty good chronology of the Eighth Whelp's involvement in the taking of all of these prizes. So here you've got all that detail laid out. The resultant chronological order shows you that the first ship he captures is that Mayflower, where he had that great gun battle. And then he captures the Christian, the Mary, three merchant vessels from Weymouth and Dartmouth, the Dove, the Sarah, and then with three other ships, captures the last four at the bottom there, Esperanza, Mary, Rainbow, and Maitre. Now, William Thomas was rewarded for his faithful service by promotion to the frigate Warwick. And you can see this listed within the summer guard list of 1645. His place aboard the Eighth Whelp was, as we noted, taken over by John Kerse. So you do a good thing, you get promoted, he got a bigger ship. The Warwick is a bigger, larger ship with more cannons and a larger crew on it. Now, there are also three other depositions from May to June 1644, which shed light on the activities of the Eighth Whelp. These are all from various persons aboard ships which had contact with the Eighth Whelp during the time that Pendarves was serving on board her. The first of these comes from Henry Borden, an English crewman who served aboard the Dove from the port of Topsham, the ship that, according to John Pendarves' deposition on 17 May 1644, was captured by the Eighth Whelp on the 3rd of November 1643. And this is document 3 that you have on your handout. It is a transcription of Henry Bondon's statement. Now, Bondon's statement is interesting because he gives details of what was on board the Dove when she was captured, including arms and 100 barrels of gunpowder. And you can see that on line 29 of his statement. So this was an arms smuggling ship that the Eighth Whelp captures. Although you can also find, it's not uncommon to find all sorts of other contraband items being found on English ships. One of the most frequently found items that is smuggled and had great commercial value was, of course, tobacco. And 17th century importation of tobacco from plantations in the colonies, the American colonies in particular, began to spread and take hold. And you can find a lot of documents that talk about the importation of tobacco. There's one very funny document in the naval records about the Eighth Whelp helping to capture one ship, and one of the testimonies says, yes, I saw the crew running down, and one soldier came up and he had rolls of tobacco stuffed down his trousers and up his shirt, trying to steal it off the ship before it got inventoried and was taxed and taken away. So tobacco was one thing that very commonly showed up and was illegal to import without paying tax to the king. Other things that were very important, and you often found them being commandeered on ships, were included spices, things we kind of take for granted now. But spices were really high-value items in the 17th century. And here you have some 17th century drawings of ginger and nutmeg and pepper. We wouldn't really think those things were necessarily that valuable, but in those days, they were as good as gold. Foodstuffs were also very frequently found on ships and were contraband items. Many of the foodstuffs, of course, were non-perishing things, things you would want to have with you aboard a ship if you couldn't get to land over a long period of time. Dried fish, olives, currants, and particularly on English ships or ships coming into England, fruit that we can't grow in England very readily, namely lemons and oranges. So all of those things you very often find become contraband items that are recaptured and commandeered. Now, there's an additional account given on the same day that Pendarves gave his second account. That is on the 27th of May, 1644. This is a deposition by Captain Reeve Williams, who commanded the Endeavour. And this ship was involved in several joint operations with the Eighth Whelp, and his testimony reveals some additional details about joint exercises, particularly with regard to the taking of the ship called the Mary. There's a deposition made 2 days after Reeve Williams makes his statement before the court. That is on the 29th of May. And this is the deposition by a Captain Thomas Plunkett, who commanded the Providence, which also was involved in several joint exercises with the Eighth Whelp, notably the capture of a ship called the Esperanza, a Spanish ship. Now, the career of Thomas Plunkett takes a rather bizarre turn after he made this deposition before the Court of the Admiralty on the 29th of May, 1644. The first clue to this is the fact that he's not listed as the captain of the Providence in the next published list of the Earl of Warwick's fleet. In fact, although the Providence herself is listed in that fleet, the name for the new commander is just left blank. Why is that? And I think a partial explanation is to be found within entries contained in the Journal of the House of Commons for the months of April and June, 1644. And together they allow us to reconstruct what was happening with Captain Plunkett and may even offer some explanation as to why Plunkett and the others are called in to give their depositions before the High Court of the Admiralty in the first place. In the Journal for the House of Commons, entry for the 4th of April, 1644, Plunkett is listed as one of five captains referred to the Lord Admiral, who is to decide, quote, either to discharge them or continue them in their employment and service for this next summer's fleet. A further clue is found in this entry for the 14th of May, 1644, from the House of Commons Journal. It's entitled Proceedings Against Plunkett, where it's ordered that Captain Thomas, he's the captain of the Eighth Whelp, and Captain Plunkett and Captain Williams are called to the Court of Admiralty. They have to give testimony on oath. And if Plunkett doesn't come, he's to be kept in prison, in safe custody, that's what that means. And Parliament orders that the Committee of the Navy write to the Lord Admiralty explaining why they had detained Captain Plunkett and outlining the nature of the case against him. Now, we can only imagine the fervent negotiations that went on behind the doors the following fortnight. In the end, Plunkett, desirous of another naval command, repented of his indiscretions, threw himself on the mercy of the court, an entry dated the 4th of June, 1644, tells us that Plunkett's petition was heard by the House of Commons. His refractoriness in refusing the oath proffered to him by the Court of Admiralty, he refused to give a testimony under oath, but repented and eventually was discharged from his restraint in prison. Parliament required that Plunkett's release from custody was conditional upon his coming clean about what he was involved in doing. And really, you find out in the end of the day that when Plunkett reveals all, that we discover that he's involved in the plundering of property belonging to a member of the House of Commons. It'd be like a captain maybe, I don't know, holding up a House of Representatives or something, or going to his house and stealing food and stealing goods. So there's an entry on the 24th of June, 1644, which reveals what all this involves. It involves a member of the House, Giles Green, and the Navy captains killed a group, a bunch of ewes and lambs. Now, probably what's happening here is they're not getting well supplied by the Navy stores. So the crew have to eat, so they land somewhere, and they happen to land at the place where this Giles Green, a member of the House of Commons, lives. They take his goods, and he doesn't like it. So don't mess with your senators and House of Representatives figures. They get you in hot water if you're not careful. In contrast, Plunkett eventually is commanded to another ship. He's appointed to command the Discovery in the Summer Guard of 1645. Now, this is a merchant ship. It's not a warship anymore. It's a merchant ship. So at one level, he's been demoted. It's an important position because it's quite a big ship, 350 tons, 130 men, 28 cannons. But it's not a warship. So he's lost his place, as it were. But let's go back for a minute to the deposition made by John Pendarves himself before the High Court of the Admiralty on the 27th of May. That's your second document. And it concerns the capture of the Sarah of Arundel. Now, Pendarves mentions in lines 14 to 19 of that deposition that he heard the confessions of the ship's master, John Broadwood, and one of the crew members, Richard Greenfield, that he was ordered by Captain Thomas to write these confessions down. He becomes the clerk, the scribe, as it were, and that he saw the two men sign their confessions. Fortunately, this signed confession by Broadwood and Greenwood has survived, along with a second confession made by Greenwood before Captain Thomas on the 24th of June, 1644. And what you discover in their confessions is that they were part of an elaborate geographic misdirection in an attempt to get ladings of contraband grain into the hands of agents loyal to Charles I. And part of this ploy involved a royalist agent named John Glyde, who bought a load of ship's corn, a shipload of corn, and arranged for it to be delivered from Arundel in Sussex, which is the far right-hand arrow, to Topsham near Exham, which is the left-hand arrow up here, the left-hand star. While in Topsham, the Sarah was rehired by two other royalists, and then she was contracted to sail to Rye, which is the second to the end arrow on the right, and she was to take on a board of hops and come back to Exeter. So it's a complex misdirection, and they forged the documents to make sure that they can travel safely to do all this. The whole point of it was to get grain to Charles I's soldiers in Exeter, because the Exeter siege had just been taking place. Now, the original contract between John Broadwood and John Damon has survived, and it sets out conditions for the ship's hire, particularly for this second load of contraband grain. Now, it looks as if, one level, as if the ship's master, John Broadhead, is a bit of a dupe. He doesn't really understand what he's being asked to do. He just says, yes, I'll sail it. I'll pick up whatever you tell me. Doesn't realize that he's being dragged into something that he may not want to be. And when the ship was captured by Captain Thomas and the 8th Whelp, Broadhead was subjected to interrogation, and he quickly revealed everything he knew. And it's at this point that John Pendarve steps onto the stage again, for Thomas brought him into function as the scribe of the proceedings, which took place aboard the 8th Whelp. So this particular document, written by Pendarves, was inscribed on board the ship. And probably the reason why the captain asks Pendarves to do this is because he's university educated, he can write, and he's part of his trusted crew. He's one of the officers, as it were. So the result is that we have a confession of Broadwood that's written in John Pendarves' hand. It's dated the 9th of January, 1644. It has John Broadwood's mark, and that suggests that Broadwood doesn't know how to read or write. He has to just make a big B, you can see down here at the bottom. A second confession by Broadwood was given before the Vice Admiral Richard Whitehead, who was the governor of Plymouth, on the 25th of January, 1644, written down by an unknown scribe. It just confirms the basic misdirection that they were trying to use to get this grain from one place to another to support Charles's army. Now, we began by noting that the fifth monarchist, John Pendarves, began his career, the early period of his life, in something of a mystery. The two sworn statements were that he made before the High Commission of the Admiralty were done in Chatham Dockyards. This is an ancient or an old etching of that. Probably at the conclusion of the 8th Whelp's tour of duty for that season of naval activity. According to Pendarves' depositions, he was present aboard the 8th Whelp during the taking of both the Dove, that was in November of 1643, and the Sarah in January 1644. Thus, both actions took place when the 8th Whelp was commanded by this Captain William Thomas, who served, as I suggested, as her captain from the spring of 1643 until the spring of 1644. And it makes sense to me to suggest that Pendarves joins the crew at the start of Captain Thomas's service as commander of that ship. So Pendarves serves as military chaplain throughout the whole of the captaincy of William Thomas. If this is right, and that's the best way to do it, there aren't many documents to show that once she goes out to sea, she doesn't come back until the year is up. So if Pendarves is on the ship at some stage, he probably joins when they first set out. If that's right, it means that Pendarves serves aboard the 8th Whelp when she first transports Capuchin monks from England to France. It means that she's on board when the ship captures that Mayflower in that naval gun battle in June of 1643. He serves 15 months or so aboard this ship, and it saw him doing a number of routine diplomatic missions, active battle engagements, as well as the endless search and seizure activities which seem to characterize the fleet as a whole, always looking for contraband items, trying to capture gunpowder, arms, anything that would support the king's cause, and if they could commandeer it, they would. So what happened to Pendarves at the end of his service aboard as a chaplain aboard the 8th Whelp? In all likelihood, he returned to Abingdon in Berkshire and began his career as a minister in the local parish in the summer of 1644. So he finishes in the spring as a Navy chaplain, then goes back to where he lived before in Abingdon. He didn't forget his military experience, however, but widened it to include service as a chaplain within Thomas Rainsborough's newly formed 7th Regiment of Foot, which was stationed at the garrison town in Abingdon in 1644. This was one of the military units that was responsible for besieging Oxford and bringing the surrender of Oxford by Charles I. It's surely not without significance that Rainsborough himself served within the Earl of Warwick's fleet, first as a captain of the Swallow, and then as captain of the Lion. And I just wonder if it could be that Pendarves and Rainsborough met at some point in their time as Navy servicemen, that they found they had mutual interests and convictions and struck up a friendship, and that when Rainsborough was transferred, Pendarves followed him. Now, I'm not aware of any direct evidence that supports that conjecture, but it does seem to make sense to me. Finally, this is the 10th document I was mentioning to you. This is one other tantalizing document from early 1656, not very long before John Pendarves dies, which you could say is evidence of his naval experience aboard the 8th while being put into service. This is an informer's letter written by a man named Thomas Allen to General Philip Skipon in London. Now, Allen ostensibly reports here on Pendarves' activity in helping to smuggle a shipload of arms from the continent to England. The letter is dated January 1656. It's written from the Dutch port of Flushing, which is near Antwerp. And if it is indeed an accurate report at all, and there's no 100% certainty about that, then we have a good example here of John Pendarves getting involved with what you could describe as the radical arm of the Fifth Monarchy Movement, helping to transport a load of pistols and rifles and muskets into England at a very crucial moment, 1656. Pendarves dies, of course, just in the autumn of 1656, and we don't hear anything else about him. But he's an interesting character. I hope you feel you know a little bit more about him and what it was like to be a military chaplain aboard a naval ship. So that's it. Thank you. Sure.
Entertain some questions.
Sure.
Was he a particular Baptist?
Yes, Pendarves was. Yes, he doesn't sign the confessions because the church that he becomes a pastor of, he doesn't become a pastor of that church until about 1650. But he knows Kiffin. He's quite involved with it, with the Abingdon Baptist Association. So yeah, he is a particular Baptist. Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. It's not an easy one to answer because you have different gradations of Fifth Monarchists. But generally, the Fifth Monarchist is a political movement who do not like the idea of having a monarchy of any sort. They want a republic-based government. And the more radical arm of them want Jesus as the head of the government. You don't even want any political figures. You want King Jesus to be the government. So it's an anti-monarchy movement. And Cromwell, in the latter part of the 1650s, is beginning to be viewed as a crypto-monarchist, a crypto-king. He's a king in everything but name. He refuses to take the crown, although many people wanted him to, and tried to persuade him to accept the crown. but he doesn't do it. But the Fifth Monarchists kind of start off hating monarchy in general, but end up hating Cromwell because he's so close to everything they despise. What else would you say about Fifth Monarchists? Probably not a very wide movement, but extremely interesting one. If you want a good book to look up, probably the best book on the Fifth Monarchist is by Bernard Kapp. It's called The Fifth Monarchy Men. Bernard Kapp was the same guy who wrote the book that you had as a slide about Cromwell's navy. So he really is a specialist in the 17th century period. And he goes through and discusses all the Fifth Monarchists and identifies a whole list of them and discusses them person by person. So, yeah.
Morris. Thanks very much. Gary, I'm curious about the actual title and role of chaplain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there a recognized naval chaplaincy service? Was he simply a minister who happened to end up on board ship? What did he do? Did he conduct service?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's hard to know exactly what it means. He never describes himself as a chaplain, and it's very hard to find 17th century documents where they use the word chaplain. What they tend to use is the word that Pendarves himself uses here to describe himself. He is a minister aboard the ship. But the letter that you saw on one of the early slides, written by the commissioners of the Admiralty, is written to Baptist and independent ministers, a list of them, including Vavasor Powell is on that list, and Pendarves is on that list. Several other Baptists, you know, George Cockayne is on that list. These are men who are being encouraged to establish what you and I would now know as a chaplaincy service. And the aim is that they can better bring the gospel message, the impact of the gospel, to the ships, to men who are serving aboard the ships. So they probably don't use a chaplaincy service as a title or as a way of describing themselves, but effectively that's what they're trying to do, I think. Yeah. It's a very good question. I should have made it a bit clearer, but there's a question here, I think. Yes, many of them were. Yeah. Wanting King Jesus, yeah, and they describe themselves as fifth monarchists because of the biblical references of Daniel. So the fifth monarchy is, you know, after the Medes, the Persians, the Romans, so on. So they're the next empire is going to be Christ's empire, really. Fifth monarchy, really, in English parlance now, kind of means, people use it in England all the time. They talk about somebody being a fifth monarchist. They don't really have a clue about what fifth monarchy means historically, but it kind of means a counterculture movement. If you're against the government or you don't like what the government is doing, you can be described generally or vaguely as, oh, you're a fifth monarchist. You know, so it means you don't like what's going on. Yeah.
Any other questions?
It's up to you, Tony.
This guy named Broadhead. I grew up on Broadhead Road, French and Indian War in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Washington, is there any relation there?
Not that I'm aware of. And Broadhead, it is quite a common name, but you even find in the statements, if you look at the transcriptions that are on the list you've got, Pendarves doesn't get the name right all the time. One time he calls him Broadhead, and other times he calls him Broadwood. So what his name really is a guess. And, of course, you can't tell from his own signature because he doesn't write. So
I didn't ask what a whelp was. He told me because I was that dumb. I didn't know what a whelp was.
Didn't know what a whelp?
Yeah.
A whelp, yeah.
He told me so.
It means a young cub, a lion's cub is a whelp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a dog. Sometimes you talk about a young dog being a whelp. It means it's usually a wild animal. A young cub or pup of a wild animal is a whelp. And it's good for a little ship to have, you know, you've got 10 of them, 10 little ones, ganging up on one big ship. You can understand why 10 whelps might be something to contend with. Would any of you like to be aboard a ship running around looking for tobacco and... You wouldn't want to do it in the English Channel. It would be a cold job. It would be a cold job.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Good. Thank you, Michael.